Lecture 22, Hellenism and the Western Mediterranean.
The Hellenistic world that we've been examining is a cultural zone that extended over the Eastern Mediterranean. And as we know, at times it went even further across into Central Asia. But the heartland we've seen was essentially that of the Eastern Mediterranean, corresponding to the region that in more recent times we've referred to as the Levant. But there is no natural barrier between the East and the Western Mediterranean. There is no mountain chain that makes it impossible to get from one side to the other. And if one can sail in a boat from Alexandria to Greece, surely one can sail onto Sicily and even onto Marseille or to Gibraltar. So an interesting question that deserves some examination, and we're going to see why it's so important in a moment, is the question of why Hellenism did not move into the Western Mediterranean. And the reason this is going to be an important question to address is because it is from the Western Mediterranean that there will eventually come a political and military force that will overwhelm the Hellenistic world, namely that of Rome. So I'd like to look in today's lecture at the question of the relationship between the Greeks, the Hellenistic Greeks in particular, and their Western Mediterranean neighbours. And this is to set the stage then for our final lectures, which will examine in more detail the specific relationship between Rome and the Hellenistic world. Hellenism, as we know, was tied to Alexander's dream of conquering Persia. He had inherited from the rest of the Greeks the notion that the Persians were the ancestral enemies. And as we've seen, it was already before Alexander's time, in the generation before him, a notion being played with by Greek intellectuals, such as Isocrates, that to take a Greek army east against the Persians might be the one way of unifying a people who, up until then, had never been politically unified. So it is historical circumstances then that dictate that Hellenism will originally move towards the east. The territorial limits of Hellenism are first determined by Alexander's agenda, as in so many other ways. It's the great man here who establishes the future course of development. But even though it may seem fairly obvious that Hellenism should go east because of those conditions, it is the case that at Alexander's death, he apparently had plans to move into the Western Mediterranean, or at least so we're told by the ancient sources. We have a quite extraordinary account in Diodorus that gives us the details of Alexander's intentions, Alexander's so-called last plans. The following were the largest and most remarkable of these plans. It was intended to build 1,000 warships larger than triremes in Phoenicia, Syria, Cilicia and Cyprus for an expedition against the Carthaginians and the other inhabitants of the coastal area of Libya, Africa, Spain and the neighbouring coasts as far as Sicily. To build a coastal road in Libya as far as the Straits of Gibraltar across all of North Africa, in other words. And, as required by such a large expedition, to build harbours and shipyards at suitable places, to build 6 expensive temples at a cost of 1,500 talents, in addition to settle cities and transplant populations from Asia to Europe and vice versa from Europe to Asia. The temples just mentioned were to be built at Delos, Delphi, Dodona, and in Macedon, and there was to be a temple of Zeus at Dion, and likewise a temple at Troy, a temple in honour of Athena. A tomb for his father Philip was to be constructed, which would be as large as the greatest of the pyramids in Egypt, which some reckon the 7 wonders of the world. Now, according to our sources, the Macedonian generals after Alexander's death came across these plans written down. They looked at them. They weren't too sure about whether any of this would be acceptable, but they also knew they couldn't suppress them. And so they read them aloud to the Macedonian army. And this is the response. When the plans had been read out, the Macedonians, although they approved highly of Alexander, nevertheless saw that the plans were extravagant and difficult to achieve, and they decided not to carry out any of those that had been mentioned. So we have a tantalizing prospect here. It is possible that Alexander was seriously contemplating a Western campaign. And so this is one of those moments when we can ask, what if? What if Alexander hadn't died at Babylon? Well, it's quite possible that Alexander would have marched all across North Africa, and that the whole nature of the Hellenistic world, the Mediterranean, the relationship between West and East, between Rome and the Greeks, between Latin and Greek, the entire nature of European culture and world history would have been different. But he died, and the plans were shelved. The plans may not actually be authentic, it's very hard to tell, but I think it is quite likely that he was planning some kind of Western campaign, and that after his death, all plans for that were dropped. There is another reason why Hellenism maintained an Eastern orientation and not a Western. Not just the fact that Alexander died before he could go there. It's because there was already a superpower in the Western Mediterranean. Carthage. Carthage had been established as a Phoenician colony as early as 800 BC. Its name, Carthadasht, in Semitic, is basically identical with Naples, that is to say, Neapolis, New City, a nice, easy colonial name. And it sat at a nodal point in the Mediterranean where the Mediterranean narrows because there are only a few hundred miles between North Africa here, Sicily, and then the toe of Italy. And it was from this important and nodal point that the Carthaginians exercised control over much of the Western Mediterranean, sailing and trading from the North African coast west and then north up the coasts of Portugal and Spain. So the presence of Carthage to the west must have acted as a kind of buffer. It certainly did for earlier Greeks because it discouraged much Greek expansion beyond Sicily. There were one or two Greek colonies in the Western Mediterranean, Marseille, of course, being the most notable. But it is certainly the case that during the classical period, while the Eastern Mediterranean was littered with Greek cities and Greek colonies all the way around the coastline of southern Italy and all the way up the Aegean and into the Black Sea and around the east, at the same time, Carthage exercised that sort of control in the Western Mediterranean, and so on the western side of the Mediterranean, the coastline is dotted with Carthaginian colonies, not Greek colonies. It's for that reason, then, that Greek colonization had never really advanced much beyond the stage that it had already achieved between 700 and 600 BC. So Carthage acted as a buffer. The important frontier between these two zones of power, and I really think we can think in terms of spheres of influence here, the Western Mediterranean and the Eastern Mediterranean, the frontier between these two is Sicily. And the colonization of Sicily even reflects this, because the eastern side of Sicily, which is basically shaped like a triangle, you may recall, the eastern side of Sicily is essentially dotted with Greek colonies. The interior of the island is largely made up of local indigenous populations, and the western side, both on the northwestern and on the southwestern side, is largely made up of Punic colonies. So in Sicily we find the westernmost expansion of Greek culture, we find the easternmost expansion of Carthaginian culture, and the poor Sicels, the native population, squeezed into the centre. There was, however, one part of the Western Mediterranean that did attract the attention of Alexander's successors, and there was one successor in particular who was interested in trying to conquer this region. The region I'm speaking of is, of course, Italy, and the man involved was Pyrrhus, king of Epirus. Epirus is the Greek kingdom located immediately to the west of Macedon. And Pyrrhus, therefore, though not a Macedonian himself, came from exactly the same northern Greek world as Philip and Alexander and Alexander's other successors. This world of northern Greece, as you'll recall, was one in which kings ruled, not democracies, and kings were constantly facing the challenge of other barons and other lords who formed their court. Pyrrhus's early life reflects exactly this kind of commotion and upheaval. As a child, he had to flee Epirus with his mother as the result of these intrigues at court. And as a young man, he'd grown up largely in exile. He never gave up his claim to the throne of Epirus, but in fact, he served for a long time as a young man in the army of Antigonus and Antigonus' son Demetrius, Polyarchetes, and later he even lived in Egypt with Ptolemy as a well-treated royal hostage. So we have a man cut from the same mold as the other Hellenistic rulers, although someone who had to fight to claim his ancestral right as king of Epirus. He was trained as a warrior by the very best generals of the day, Antigonus, Demetrius, Ptolemy, certainly the very best. And there were many men of the age who believed that he was the nearest thing to Alexander, that he resembled Alexander in his flair, in his tactical skill, in his bravery. On one occasion, Antigonus was asked who he thought was the finest general, and he replied, "Pyrrhus, if he lives to be an old man." So there was also this sense that he, like Alexander, might burn out a blazing star. During the decade of the 290s, while he was still in his 20s, and as he was still trying to reclaim his kingdom of Epirus, Pyrrhus fought with his former patron, Demetrius Poliorcetes, and the 290s and the 280s saw the two men, Pyrrhus on the west, and Demetrius on the east, invading each other's territory of Epiros and Macedon with varying degrees of success. This was an example of the typical stalemate of wars that we've seen in the early Hellenistic period, and Pyrrhus might have perished in one of these wars and have become a footnote in history, but for the significant fact that in 280 BC, the people of Tarentum, modern-day Taranto in southern Italy, called upon him, asking him to cross over the Adriatic into Italy and to help them fight their enemy, the Romans. This was going to be the first confrontation between a Hellenistic successor, a Hellenistic prince, and the Romans. And so it's a monumental event. Over the course of the next 6 years in the 270s, Pyrrhus fought a series of campaigns in southern Italy and in Sicily, once reaching as close as 40 miles south of Rome. He's a little bit like Hannibal in that he got very close to the gates of Rome, although this of course is before Hannibal by a good 60 years. He probably won more battles than he lost. But an invading army is always limited by its own size and by the success with which it can win the support of the local population, while the defending army, in this case the Romans, is always fighting on its own soil. It has easier access to supplies and, of course, can be reinforced from its own territory and by its own population. So the six-year campaign becomes a kind of war of attrition to see who can win, the brilliant general or the dogged Romans who can survive defeat after defeat. After one particularly bloody victory, when he was congratulated by his generals, Pyrrhus is supposed to have remarked, "Another victory as costly as that and I'll have lost the war." The origin, of course, of our expression in English of a Pyrrhic victory, one that is too costly in the long run. And eventually, in fact, he did lose the war. He quit Italy entirely in 274, and he died not long after in 272 during yet another one of these marauding raids, an attack in southern Greece on the city of Argos. His campaigns present probably the only chance, and this is one of the reasons why I think it's significant, his campaigns, those 6 years in the 270s, represent, I think, the only chance of Rome and Italy falling under the direct political control of a Hellenistic dynast. If Pyrrhus had been successful, Italy would have become a Hellenistic kingdom, like Syria and like Macedon and like Egypt. But it didn't. So history took a very different course indeed. Pyrrhus's failure marks a dramatic turning point in the history of Hellenism, since it's, as I said, the first confrontation between a Hellenistic power and Rome. In military terms, these were the first full-scale campaigns in which Roman legions fought against Greek armies trained in the Macedonian style with the Macedonian phalanx. The army of Pyrrhus was led by a general who was thoroughly imbued with all of the tactical lessons of Philip and Alexander. So from a military point of view, it's a confrontation of two very different styles of warfare. The short-term result had been even, with some battles won by the Romans and some battles won by Pyrrhus, but the long-term results had been a Roman victory as Pyrrhus was gradually worn down. And, as Plutarch notes, shortly after this, Rome was to go on and to conquer the rest of Italy and the rest of Sicily. So, I think that one of the important features of Pyrrhus's campaigns, apart from the fact that they signify the first confrontation of Hellenistic East and Roman West, is that they may have contributed to the idea in Rome of territorial expansion. That shortly after this, they took over most of the Italian peninsula and moved into Sicily as well, which became their first overseas province. In cultural terms, the victories of the Romans over Pyrrhus also played a significant role in determining the very complex response of the Romans to Greek culture. And now we turn our attention a little away from political machinations to talking about how the Romans treat Hellenism as a culture. In the aftermath of Rome's defeat of Pyrrhus, Greek culture acquired a foothold in Rome. How so? Well, some of this was as a direct result of Rome's military victory. For example, in 275 BC, following the victory of Pyrrhus, the Roman general Manlius Curius Dentatus put on a triumph. The triumph, of course, is a great procession held in downtown Rome in which the glorious general is brought in victory through the streets of the city with his soldiers coming along behind him, followed by a great display of the booty won in battle. And in this triumph, this victory parade, there were hundreds of Greek artworks on display, Greek artworks that had been captured by the victorious Romans. What I think this probably encouraged, and it certainly found fertile soil in Rome, what it encouraged was the attitude towards the Greeks that the Romans never really lost ever after, and that was that Greek culture was a commodity. It was statues and bronze and gold bowls and marble statues, and that this Greek culture was something which was really theirs as the spoils of victory. The Romans deserved this because they had defeated the Greeks. When Rome sacked Tarentum in 272, and please recall, the city we're talking about, Tarentum, is not an Italian city. It's located, yes, on the Italian peninsula, but from the point of view of the Romans, it's Greek. Its inhabitants speak Greek. When Rome sacked Tarentum in 272 BC, after Pyrrhus had been kicked out, all the statues and all the other artworks, the bronze vessels, the paintings, the silver plate, and so forth, were all carted off to Rome. So the Romans from the early 3rd century got used to the idea of seeing these victory parades in which Greek culture was on display as something that had been won by a victorious Roman general conquering these effete Greeks. This attitude remained remarkably consistent through the Roman Republic, this idea that Greek stuff was stuff to be plundered, to be brought back, to be shipped back. So that by the first century, the Roman general Sulla was exporting not just statues or paintings, that was small fry. His men actually dismantled entire temples, put them on board boats, and shipped them back to Rome. One of them actually sank along the way. So somewhere south of Italy, there's a Greek temple in the water waiting to be excavated and put back together again. The Roman response to Greek culture was not limited to the sacking of Greek treasures, because the other booty that came back was, of course, prisoners of war, slaves. And ex-slaves began to enter the population of Rome. People who'd come to Rome as captives of war, people who stayed on then with Roman families even after they were given their manumission and liberated. And of course there were Greek merchants as well, Greek free men as well as freed men and slaves. And as the population of Rome began to receive this infusion, quite literally, of Greek blood and Hellenistic blood from all parts of the Eastern Mediterranean, what this brought to Rome was an increasing exposure to Greek ideas, Greek beliefs, Greek culture, Greek letters, in other words. Now, this exposure in some instances was relatively easy for the Romans to manage. Roman religion, for example, could easily adapt to the gods and the goddesses of the Greeks. Like other ancient religions, Roman religion was essentially one that worked by syncretism. If your God and my God appear to be similar, then we fuse the two and see it as essentially two names for the same thing. There was not this exclusivity, this dogmatic approach to deity that we find in monotheistic and modern religions. For example, in 293, a plague broke out in Rome, and the Romans dedicated a temple, of course, to the god who helped them to get over the plague, a god of healing. Now, we've already spoken about this Greek god, or this god in his Greek context, as Asclepius. We've already talked about the cures at the Asclepium. The Romans worshipped him as well. They just simply Latinized his name, changing Asclepius from the Greek into Aesculapius in Latin. But it's essentially the same god, with his name merely transformed a little. In some cases, they didn't even bother to change the name much at all. Apollo was worshipped under the same name in Rome as he was in Greece. Jupiter is nothing more than the Latin pronunciation for Zeus Pater, Zeus the father of the gods, which is, of course, exactly what Jupiter is as well. In 249 BC, the Greek divine couple of Hades, god of the underworld, and Persephone, the daughter of Demeter, who he'd carried off, this divine couple was honoured in a celebration at Rome, commemorating the victory over Tarentum. And again here, all that happens is the Greek name Persephone is slightly changed into its Latin form of Proserpina. So at a religious level, the exchange between the two cultures was very easy to manage because they already spoke a similar religious language, if you will. What about at the level of cultural transformation? Because we are really talking now about hundreds and thousands of Hellenistic Greeks gradually coming into the city of Rome itself, bringing with them their Greek culture. Well, we actually know of quite specific instances of cultural transformation taking place in Italy, and specifically Rome, as a result of this process. A man named Livius Andronicus, his name is interesting because Andronicus is in fact a Greek name, or Andronicus, if you will, is a Greek name, whereas Livius is a Roman name. This character originally is from the Greek south, from Tarentum, but comes to Rome and comes into the household of a Roman family and eventually gets a Roman name. This transplanted Greek from Tarentum, who was brought to Rome as a slave, translates Homer's epic poems into Latin. So here we have now, from the early part of the 3rd century, the Romans reading their own version of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but not in Greek, in Latin. Livius Andronicus also wrote and produced at least 10 tragedies for the Roman stage, and each one of them, interestingly enough, was based on a Greek story, so that the Romans from this early stage in the 3rd century can go to the theatre and what they're seeing on stage, not the stories of their heroes fighting against the Etruscans, but rather heroes such as Ajax and Achilles, good Greek heroes, but now being packaged for Roman consumption on the stage. Now, this contact between the two cultures left the Romans quite ambivalent. I mean, on the one hand, they're importing all this stuff as the spoils of war. It's the stuff that they won because they're superior to the Greeks. On the other hand, culturally, the Greeks come from a long and glorious tradition with wonderful poetry and great artwork. And so, in some ways, the Romans, looking at the Greeks, feel a kind of cultural cringe, almost a sort of inferiority, at the same time as they feel a kind of moral superiority. It's a very tortured and ambiguous attitude. I think the nearest one can find in more recent times is perhaps in the strange relationship culturally between America and England, the sort of thing captured by Henry James, where there is sometimes a sense that the English culture may be older, but American culture is more vigorous and more new. It's an analogy you may wish to play with. Let me give you some instances, though, of exactly how the Romans, in their early stage of contact with the Greeks, dealt with this. Well, in 155 BC, an embassy came from the Greek world to deal with the Romans. The Romans by now were one of the major powers in the Mediterranean, and it was led by a Greek philosopher named Carneades. And over the course of 2 days, Carneades wished to demonstrate the power of Greek philosophy and the power of what the Greeks would call aristics, essentially the science of debating. And as we all know, the essence of good debating is that you can take any proposition and in one speech argue in favour of it, and on another occasion, in a second speech, argue against it. And this is exactly what Carneades did. It was a good example of what the Greeks in their traditional curriculum would call epideictic oratory, display oratory. Okay, it's an attempt to show people what the power of oratory is by speaking on the subject of justice one day, that justice is possible, and then the next day demonstrating, of course, that justice is an illusion and impossible. Well, from a Greek point of view, this is a good example of how to display the powers of oratory, and it's meant to show people you should really learn oratory because it'll equip you with these skills. From the Roman point of view, it was infuriating, because it meant that these Greeks, or these Graeculi, these little Greeks, as the Romans often termed them, were essentially duplicitous, that they were dishonest, that you really couldn't trust them, and that when a Greek spoke, you never knew whether he was telling the truth or whether he was just putting one over you. Cato, the stern Roman censor, was so alarmed by this that he had the ambassadors instantly expelled from Rome. This was really regarded as somehow a deep moral threat to the integrity of Roman culture, because he was worried about the corrupting influence of this essentially university professor. And yet, think a little further about this, and we find it's a very interesting episode, because the speeches delivered by Carneades were delivered in Greek. And the only people that they could corrupt were people who spoke and understood Greek. In other words, there already was a contact between the two cultures. There was an audience for this kind of material. Cato called the Greeks a vile and unteachable race. And yet, he himself knew Greek, and he was able to speak Greek and to read Greek fluently. So that, whether we like it or not, the Romans already were being exposed to Hellenistic culture and, in a sense, were being Hellenized even against their will. Now, in the lectures to follow, I'm going to pursue this even further and also map the specific political circumstances that led to the Greek involvement, to the Roman involvement in the Greek world. But I want to finish with something slightly different, because I want to give the last word today to Pyrrhus, this wonderful Alexander-like king who's dominated our story so far. The reason I want to finish here is because we have an anecdote involving Pyrrhus which I think absolutely sums up how the Hellenistic kings saw their mission. And it's a story that involves the West, so it gives us an idea of what they thought of going west towards the Romans. This is a story that involves Pyrrhus and a Greek philosopher named Kineas. We've already talked on previous occasions about the way in which philosophers are often seen to be the kind of moral equivalent of kings. They're often their advisors. See what Kineas does with Pyrrhus in this little exchange. When Kineas at this time saw that Pyrrhus was eager to sail to Italy, finding him at leisure, he started the following conversation. "Pyrrhus, the Romans are said to be good soldiers and to rule many warlike peoples. Should a god grant us success over them, how shall we use our victory?" And Pyrrhus replied, "Kineas, the answer to your question is obvious. Once the Romans are defeated, no barbarian or Greek city there can resist us. We shall immediately secure control over the whole of Italy." "And how large, strong, and powerful she is, I imagine you know better than anyone else." Kineas paused a little, and then he said, "Sire, once we've taken Italy, what shall we do?" And Pyrrhus, not seeing yet what Kineas was leading to, replied, "Sicily nearby stretches out her hands to us, a wealthy, populous land, very easy to capture. There's nothing there, Kineas, but revolution, anarchy in the cities, and excitable demagogues now that Agathocles is dead." And so Kineas replies, "Well, yes, that seems quite plausible. But is the capture of Sicily the end of our expedition?" And Pyrrhus replied, "May God grant us a victory and success. That'll be a preliminary to a great achievement. Libya, Africa, and Carthage would then be within easy reach. And who could keep us away from them when Agathocles, who secretly escaped from Syracuse and crossed over with a few ships, very nearly captured them? Can anyone dispute that once we've conquered these, none of our enemies will be able to resist us?" "Certainly not," said Kineas. "Clearly, with such power behind us, we'll be able to recover Macedon and to rule Greece. When we've established our domination everywhere, what shall we do?" And this is the essence of the wonderful exchange between the king and the philosopher. And Pyrrhus laughed and said, we shall have ample leisure. Life, my friend, will be a daily drinking party, and we shall entertain each other with conversation. At which point Kineas interrupted Pyrrhus and said, well then, what is it that prevents us from having a drinking party now and enjoying leisure among ourselves if we so wish? The possibility is already there and costs no effort, so why achieve the same result through blood, toil, and danger? And of course, Pyrrhus had no response to that. It's a wonderful story at so many levels. It both exemplifies the relationship of king and philosopher. It also gives us an idea of why Pyrrhus was looking to the West. Simply, he was trying to do another Alexander. That's all, to conquer the West. And the great irony of his entire career is that while he was, of course, militarily unsuccessful, he actually set in train a series of events that would eventually lead to the Hellenization of Rome and the Romanization of the East.